race with a 700,000-strong army in the south that combines South Korean and U.S. forces. In the north, the population is nearing starvation conditions, according to aid agencies. Volatile is how the north is described, with deaths in its high ranks and defections at the top. And add to that a sense of turmoil in the south, be it political or economic, and it's simply an unhealthy development that can upset the status quo, which is a tense peace.
What does South Korea make of all the recent deaths in North Korea?
Well, speculation about a possible purge has actually been kept to a minimum. It is true that just days after North Korea's defense minister died of a heart attack, another key defense official has died of, quote, incurable disease. It's tempting to want to extrapolate something from that, but these were older men, and the consensus is that they were not victims of a purge, but rather died of natural causes. Having said that, the displacement those deaths cause in such a very carefully constructed regime combined with a very embarrassing defection of the top government ideologue has people concerned about whether Kim Jong-il is remaking his government.
Preliminary peace talks with the North start tomorrow in New York. How much can they accomplish?
Well, there is no official peace treaty that ended the Korean War. There's a truce. The North has been eager to undo it, but they've wanted to rewrite a peace accord with the U.S., not the enemy, South Korea. And at the very least, this meeting brings the two nations face-to-face. They have to sit down and look at one another. And like peace talks of the past, they're arguing about the shape of the table, so maybe that's a good sign they're real. But this is the beginning of a long process to end a stalemate that's lasted over 40 years.
NPR's Julie McCarthy in Seoul. China says it will increase defense spending 15% this year. The announcement was made at the annual National People's Congress. In the past, similar increases barely kept up with China's double-digit inflation. Now inflation is down to 6%, so there's an actual increase in spending to modernize China's antiquated military. NPR's Mary Kay Magstad reports from Beijing on what the increase means to China's neighbors.
With almost 3 million troops, China has the largest standing army in the world. But even with this year's 15% budget increase, China's military is still relatively cash-strapped. Its leaders would love to buy more destroyers, submarines, and fighter jets, especially from Russia, but can't even meet some of Russia's bargain basement prices. The current budget increase will go toward buying some new equipment, as well as to increase the often substandard wages of soldiers and improve training. Last year, when China conducted war games and launched missiles in the Taiwan Straits, it created jitters, but few military experts believe that China was actually capable then of invading and holding Taiwan. Arthur Ding is an expert on Chinese and Taiwanese military affairs at Taiwan's National Chengchi University in Taipei.
I would say the launch of the missile signifies that they don't have the conventional capability to launch the invasion.
At least not yet. And Taiwan's recent procurement of F-16s, Mirage 2000s, and new battleships hasn't helped. But China is working hard to tip the balance in its favor. Premier Li Peng called for a stronger military in his opening speech to the National People's Congress.
Governments at all levels should support the Chinese People's Liberation Army in its efforts to carry out a strategy of active defense and to take the road of further but better troops with Chinese characteristics.
From the Chinese government's point of view, active defense means being able to project power beyond China's land borders. China also claims most of the South China Sea as its own and wants the Blue Water Navy capability to defend it. Even more, China wants military leverage with which to convince Taiwan to rejoin the mainland. With Hong Kong returning to Chinese control this July and Macau just 2.5 years later, Taiwan is the next target. Tai Ming-chung is a Hong Kong-based expert on the Chinese military. He says the current perception among many military analysts that China is more than a decade away from being able to invade Taiwan could be wrong.
The Chinese have been improving their capabilities. They're buying more from the Russians. And the Taiwanese, they may not be as good as people believe. So I think that perhaps in a much shorter period of time, the Chinese will have the capabilities significantly to deter the Taiwanese.
China's aim is to have a leaner, meaner military with fewer troops, but with state-of-the-art equipment. Considering that China's military had come from being decades behind in technology, it's gaining fast. Despite the government's repeated claim that China will never pose a threat to its neighbors, Many of China's neighbors, especially Taiwan, are still watching with unease. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
Good morning, I'm Bob Edwards. You've heard of drug suspects flushing the evidence down the toilet. Yesterday in Miami, customs inspectors found more than 3,200 pounds of cocaine already in toilets that were shipped from Colombia. In Pensacola, Rosie Lee Hill was convinced that a drug dealer sold her some counterfeit crack cocaine, so she went to the police to complain. They determined the crack was real and arrested her. You're listening to NPR's Morning Edition.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. Young people are beginning to use drugs, especially marijuana, at a younger age than ever before. This according to a survey by the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. It says marijuana use by youngsters in the 4th through 6th grades has doubled. The poll says school children don't see the risk and are more likely to believe drugs are acceptable. The president of the group, Richard Bonnet, says the average age for trying pot is now 13. He urges parents to talk to their children frequently and at length about the dangers of drugs. President Clinton issued a directive this morning barring any federal agency from supporting, funding, or undertaking research on human cloning. The president also called for a voluntary moratorium on all privately funded research on human cloning. He was prompted by new research disclosed over the weekend in which two rhesus monkeys were cloned.
Science often moves faster than our ability to understand its implications. That is why we have a responsibility to move with caution and care, to harness the powerful forces of science and technology so that we can reap the benefit while minimizing the potential danger.
He wants any research on human cloning put on hold until a medical ethics advisory panel can study the issue. President Clinton returns to Arkansas today to survey damage and comfort survivors of Saturday's tornadoes by helicopter and by foot. He'll get a look at the hardest hit areas in Arkadelphia and near Little Rock. Federal Emergency Management Director James Lee Witt is in Arkansas, but he says the government is also getting help to those displaced by flooding in the Midwest and South.
Kentucky, you know, has some serious flooding, as well as Ohio. Tennessee was hit. Texas was hit. But West Virginia was hit. So there's several states we're working in now. We expect probably a request from the governor of Kentucky and Ohio today for assistance. But we're already in the states helping them, providing technical assistance.
The Ohio River is expected to crest in Cincinnati area sometime tomorrow at 12 feet above flood stage. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is appearing before the House Budget Committee this morning. He told the panel he sees a 100% probability the government is overcompensating the 60 million Americans receiving Social Security and other government benefits. Greenspan says the overcompensation is the result of a flawed consumer price index, and he suggests a two-track approach to correcting its exaggeration. The Index of Leading Economic Indicators posted its largest increase in 8 months in January. The Conference Board of New York reports the index rose 0.3%. The Commerce Department reports new home sales rose unexpectedly in January to the highest level in nearly 11 years, up 8.6%. On Wall Street, the Dow's down 2 points in moderate trading. This is NPR. Lawyers defending Unabomber suspect Theodore Kaczynski have asked a federal judge to throw out all the evidence seized from his Montana cabin when he was arrested last year. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
The motion to suppress the evidence covers all the materials observed or seized last April when federal agents arrested the reclusive math professor. That includes Kaczynski's handwritten journal in which the federal authorities claim he takes credit for all the Unabomber explosions. The motion filed late Monday also challenges the validity of the government's analysis of Kaczynski's writings, which authorities say link him to the 33,000-word Unabomber Manifesto. His attorneys also say the prosecution fails to place Kaczynski in locations where bombs were mailed or detonated. The prosecution has 2 weeks in which to reply, and the defense another 2 weeks to answer the prosecution. A hearing is set for May 16th. I'm Richard Gonzalez reporting.
A few days ago, defense attorneys for Oklahoma bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh called their client's reported confession a hoax. Now they say it was faked by them. and they're accusing the Dallas Morning News of stealing it. The defense team says the document was concocted to persuade someone they suspected of involvement in the bombing to talk to defense investigator. Stephen Jones, McVeigh's lead attorney, has demanded an investigation. The Dallas Morning News is denying any wrongdoing. The wife of slain Olympic wrestler David Schultz has filed a wrongful death lawsuit against multimillionaire John DuPont. Nancy Schultz says he must be held responsible for the murder of her husband. Last week, DuPont was found guilty of murdering Schultz but mentally ill. Mrs. Schultz is now seeking unspecified compensatory and punitive damages from DuPont. I'm Jean Cochran in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
Peru's President Alberto Fujimori said yesterday Cuba is willing to grant asylum to leftist rebels holding 72 people hostage at the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima. He made the announcement after meeting in Havana with Cuba's president, Fidel Castro. Castro said later he had a moral obligation to try to resolve the hostage dispute peacefully. Spokesmen for the rebels told news agencies they were not interested in Cuba's offer. While Fujimori was in Cuba, government officials and the rebels held more talks. From Lima, John Miller reports on what may be signs of progress.
Every few days since February 11th, a white sedan with tinted windows has pulled up to a side door of the Japanese ambassador's residence, picked up rebel negotiators, driven across the street to a private house, and disappeared into a basement garage. After a few hours, the car has made the return trip, and then moments later, there's been an announcement through a megaphone from the International Commission overseeing the talks. This is from the statement made after yesterday's meeting, read by Canadian Ambassador Anthony Vincent.
The discussions took place in an atmosphere of cordiality, which we regard as positive. The Commission of Guarantors can indicate that both sides are completing their proposal, which, without encompassing agreement, will clearly establish their position. The next meeting will take place on Wednesday, March the 5th. Thank you.
As usual, there was no indication of what was discussed. But the very fact that this scene has become routine is taken by many to be a sign that things are moving forward. For more than 6 weeks, from late December into early February, there was no contact at all between the two sides. As the rebels and the government dug in their heels, the police began a policy of deliberate provocation. At that point, the possibility of a peaceful solution looked remote. Then, under pressure from Japan, President Fujimori agreed to try harder to pursue a negotiated settlement, reserving the right to use force should any harm come to the hostages. Officially, the talks going on now are preliminary conversations designed to set an agenda for substantive negotiations later on. Enrique Sileri is editor of the Lima news magazine Caretas. He says he, like many others here, is encouraged simply by the willingness of both sides to keep talking.
I think that it's very important that they're doing it. I mean, you've got to talk. You start developing a degree of communication. Of course, several ideas that could be developed and are probably being developed. I mean, after all, they've already gone in there for 8 times, you know, and each conversation lasts for about 3 or 4 hours. You know, they must be talking about something.
The main sticking point, as it has been since the beginning, is the rebels' main demand for the release of hundreds of their comrades from prison. President Fujimori says flatly that he will not release any prisoners. So the question becomes, what can the government offer short of letting people out of jail? One frequently mentioned option is to commit to improving the often inhuman conditions in Peru's prisons. Another is to review the sentences of some of the lower-ranking Tupac Amaru members in jail. With Cuba apparently now offering asylum to the rebels, the long-standing government offer of safe passage takes on a concreteness that it didn't have before. The rebels, who are known to be inspired by Cuba, have said repeatedly that they have no interest in leaving Peru. They say they want to continue their fight from their base in the jungle. But the government clearly hopes that as time goes on, a ticket to Havana will look like an attractive way out. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Lima.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. Doctors and hospitals increasingly are using computers to store and retrieve their patients' medical information. But violations of doctor-patient confidentiality have led to a debate over who should have access to computerized medical records. Tomorrow, the National Research Council will offer its recommendations on protecting medical privacy. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports on the changes in collecting and disseminating medical records.
Medical information has been somewhat slow joining the so-called information revolution. For the most part, doctors still work with pages and pages of written notes that add up to individual medical charts that document everything from family history, weight, and blood pressure to recent hospitalizations. But these paper charts are fast becoming outdated, says Georgetown University law professor Larry Gostin.
We are developing a massive health information infrastructure. This is an infrastructure that people are envisaging would have electronic data so that your information would be available with the push of a button from New York to Los Angeles to Tokyo, in fact. We may develop pre-birth to post-death record of every individual. It would involve a lot of prenatal testing, including genetic testing, all the way through to your death and even your autopsy.
So for people who get sick or involved in an accident away from their home, physicians anywhere will be able to access their entire medical history. That's good news for patients. But at the same time, says lawyer A.G. Breitenstein, it could offer an opportunity to those who have more sinister goals in mind. With paper charts, she says, there's an actual human being who monitors their use. At hospitals, for example, these people hand charts over only to authorized physicians or nurses. With computer systems, Breitenstein says, there is less security.
You don't have someone like that sort of policing the gates, as it were. So you have a huge opportunity for folks who are not supposed to be looking at people's records within institutions, accessing people's medical records without their consent, often without their knowledge.
Take the case of this mother of two young children who does not want her name used. Her privacy was already invaded when she was hospitalized 2 months ago, and a hospital secretary, who also happened to be an acquaintance, accessed her medical records and found out that she was HIV positive. The acquaintance then went on to tell a number of other people.
No one, you know, basically knew, and that was it. And that was the way that I had chosen for it to be. I was having a hard time dealing with it anyway and accepting it. And then once I had started to finally, you know, accept it, this happened to me. What it's done is it set me back, you know, because now I'm back to the paranoia, you know, the worrying all the time. Who else knows? It was something that I just wanted to state private.
Then, says lawyer Breitenstein, who directs the Boston-based Justice Resource Institute, there are people who simply sell medical information. And in today's world of cost consciousness, she says, that information becomes a valuable commodity.
People have been selling people's Social Security numbers to insurers who want to cherry pick for older, you know, clients who might be eligible for certain types of Medicare, Medicaid, and they want to pick the healthiest people. So they pay record keepers for lists of names and numbers. We want to insure the well population because we want to get to keep the money.
And most people, says lawyer Larry Gostin, have no idea how many people already have access to their medical information.
It might go to the Medical Information Bureau in Massachusetts, which collects all information that's given for insurance purposes, and so that if you've got some kind of private insurance, it would go there. If you're in a managed care organization, it would go to many people within the managed care organization. If you're employed, it might go to your employer sponsor who sponsors the health plan. It could then go to a researcher that might want to do research on, say, a genetic propensity for breast cancer or mental illness. If you've got a condition that might affect the public health, it might go to a public health department, to the Centers for Disease Control or a state public health department. If you're on Medicare or Medicaid, it might go into those kinds of databases.
And that's minimal compared to what will likely happen as computerized information systems become even more common. In the future, lawyer A.G. Breitenstein says there will likely be even greater demand for medical information by even more people. Some will have reasonable justifications for wanting the information. Even so, she says it's the patient who must be in charge of whether that information is used.
Patients should be able to interact with the healthcare system as a whole and control the information. If a patient says that they want to go to a hospital and get treated and not become part of a grand sort of health information data experiment, they should be able to do that.
The Department of Health and Human Services is also working to come up with recommendations for governing medical information to send to Congress. Information privacy consultant Robert Gelman, who heads that effort, says there's some very important benefits from extensive information gathering.
Privacy is not the only value in the medical care system that's important. We also are concerned about providing high-quality care. We're concerned about providing care to lots of people. And we're concerned about keeping costs down. And there's a tension between all of these goals. You can't have as much of each of them as you would like. There is a trade-off.
A good example, says Gelman. Not long ago, health researchers tracked the names of women who took the anti-nausea drug, DES, while they were pregnant. In doing so, the researchers found that the drug caused certain cancers in the children of these women.
And the link was made by looking at medical records to determine that when the pregnant women took the drug, that somehow this affected their children. And it was a study that took place over many locations and actually over a generation. And to collect all the information and make the link between cause and effect here required access to large numbers of medical records.
And in that case, access to the information, including the names of the patients, was critical, says Gelman, to the success of the investigation. Lawyer Larry Gostin takes the point a bit further. A robust sharing of information, he argues, would serve the public health enormously.
We have a huge amount of data about a whole range of diseases. Cancer, heart disease, schizophrenia. But all of this information is just kept by an individual doctor or by an individual health maintenance organization or other managed care organization, and it's not shared. If we could have systematic studies, retrospective studies, to look back at diseases, their outcomes, their causes, there would be a great deal of information we could find out about the history, the natural history of those diseases, about what worked best, what treatments are best.
A lot of medical research is already governed by rules that require researchers to justify their need for medical information and then document how they plan to use it. But there are no rules at all for those other interests who want access to medical information, like law enforcement officials, fraud investigators, and people who monitor cost and utilization. For policy consultants like Robert Gelman, who's advising the federal government, the challenge is complex. Design rules that respond to both the privacy needs of individual patients and to the greater public good that might be served by extensive sharing of medical information. I'm Patricia Naimond reporting.
Voters in St. Louis today will choose a Democratic nominee for mayor, and today's winner likely will win the general election. St. Louis hasn't elected a Republican mayor since 1945. Another tradition has been on display in the 1997 campaign, racial politics. The population of St. Louis is divided almost evenly between blacks and whites, and observers say it looks as though the two leading candidates will split the vote along racial lines. What's unexpected about all this is that both the leading Democratic candidates are black. From St. Louis, Jim Dryden reports.
A road known to locals as Highway 40 runs through the middle of St. Louis and divides it almost in half, both geographically and racially. University of Missouri St. Louis political scientist Terry Jones says that division through the city's heart is at the heart of St. Louis politics.
because it is highly segregated residentially, stemming back to zoning ordinances and other practices employed in the early 20th century. It's remained residentially segregated, with an African-American population concentrated in the north part of the city and a white population concentrated in the south part. If you're a white running for office, you want to try to at least peel off 15-20% of the African-American vote. Conversely, if you're an African-American running for office, you want to achieve the same results in the white community.
Jones says in spite of the fact that both leading candidates are African-American, this mayoral election is playing on those traditional racial divisions. 4 years ago, incumbent Freeman Bosley Jr. became the city's first African-American mayor. The challenger, Clarence Harmon, was the city's first African-American police chief. They pledged to work together, but never got along, and in December of 1995, Harmon abruptly retired, citing frustration with the politics of the police board. He's come back to challenge Bosley for mayor.
Clarence Harmon spent $2,000 on a gold-plated police badge for himself. At the same time, he cut the department's budget.
Check out my new badge! Gold-plated!
Freeman Bosley Jr. fights crime the...
Harmon campaign staffers believe this Bosley commercial uses Amos and Andy stereotypes. Bosley staffers say the voice is meant to be Barney Fife from The Andy Griffith Show. The commercial and the reaction to it are emblematic of how race is a sub-theme in the life of St. Louis and has been, perhaps ever since Dred Scott sued for his freedom from slavery here and lost. Eric Mink grew up in St. Louis. He now works as a television critic for the New York Daily News.
I think you can make a case that race is a subtext everywhere, that this country, as the O.J. Simpson verdict in the criminal case sort of highlighted, race is something we have not got beyond, that we've not really come to grips with and certainly not resolved. That is definitely the case in St. Louis, but St. Louis historically has been reluctant to the point of obsession to acknowledge that. And so race can be addressed in St. Louis, it appears, only on a hidden agenda kind of basis.
In the language of St. Louis politics, North Side is often a code word for black, South Side for white.
How you doing? Hi, I'm Freeman Bosley. Good to see you. And what's your name?
Jesse.
Jesse. All right then, Jesse. You want to show
polls indicate that 80 to 90% of Bosley's support comes from African American voters in North St. Louis, while 80 to 90% of Harmon's support comes from South Side whites. Judging from the talk, you'd think this was a straight-up white versus black election. While both candidates have at times fueled the fires, each complains he's a victim. Some Harmon supporters say Bosley caters too much to North St. Louis, and white folks lose out. Harmon himself says Bosley speaks one way on the North Side, but differently in the South. Freeman Bosley, Jr.
That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is the fact that when I do something and a black person benefits, white people say everything I do is for the blacks. Or if I do something and a white person benefits, black people say everything I do is for the whites. I'm just the mayor stuck in the middle trying to do the best job that I can to deliver a quality of services to everybody.
Some Bosley supporters say they oppose Harmon because he tries to be white. Clarence Harmon.
Well, you know, it's not a pleasant thought. I don't feel great about the fact of that challenge, that charge being levied at me. But it's the kind of thing that demagogic politicians have always done in this community as well as others. Race has been an issue and used variously by all sorts of politicians to gain advantage. They say I'm not black because I have white support. I have black support as well, but they seldom mention that.
So we'll see. Well, we want to stay, so.
Won't let you down, I promise not to
let you. Not going to stay if Mr. Bosley stays, that's for sure.
Surrounding all the talk about division and unity are major challenges facing the city. Like many industrial cities, St. Louis has had to deal with a changing economy. Declines in the automotive and defense industries have led many to look for work elsewhere. You don't have to travel too far from the Arch, the monument to manifest destiny, to see abandoned homes and businesses left behind by people who moved westward to the suburbs. The wealthy and middle class are leaving. The old and the poor remain. In the last 30 years, the city has lost 500,000 people to the suburbs or elsewhere. Schools continue to deteriorate. Though crime rates have declined, the perception that the city is unsafe remains.
It's got to happen soon because... If you look, like in my neighborhood, there's more trash left out in the alley after the dumpster passes than there was in the dumpster to begin with.
Yeah.
There are those who wonder whether the politics of this contentious election is overshadowing hard talk about what St. Louis really needs to thrive. But you have to admit, it makes for great theater, says St. Louis Post-Dispatch columnist Bill McClellan. He riles his readers four times a week, hoping to prod the city forward with humor. That's tricky, he says, in a city that likes to look back on the glory days of the 1904 World's Fair.
I don't know. I think the city has been sliding downhill since 1904. And, you know, we have a lot of momentum going downhill now. So I don't know if we were ever destined for greatness. And I have a hard time thinking that either Clarence Harmon or Freeman Bosley Jr. can arrest this slide.
Well, and how are you? How's it going? What's going on, man?
Voter turnout is expected to be heavy. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Dryden in St. Louis.
This is NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards.
NPR is solely responsible for this program. Copies of Morning Edition are available. Call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Toll-free, 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and Hewlett-Packard, providing computer communications and measurement products for business, industry, science, education, and personal use. Vintage Books, paperback publisher of Bury Me Standing, The Gypsies and Their Journey by Isabel Fonseca, and Ericsson, developing telecommunication solutions for customers in more than 130 countries throughout the world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good morning. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat meets today with Republican congressional leaders. I'm Bob Edwards. Today is Tuesday, March 4th, and this is NPR's Morning Edition. The United Nations Security Council today considers Israel's plan to build housing for Jews in Arab East Jerusalem. Defense Secretary William Cohen meets today with German leaders in Bonn. NATO Secretary General Javier Solana is speaking today in London. Enlargement of the European Union is on the agenda today at a summit in Brussels. Britain's Prince Charles is in Saudi Arabia today. And Mexican officials arrive in El Salvador today to begin free trade talks. The news is next.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. Sales of new homes rose sharply in January. That's according to the Commerce Department, which says sales were helped by unseasonably warm weather in the Northeast and the South. NPR's John Idsley reports. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress today he believes there is nearly a 100% probability that the government is overpaying the 60 million Americans receiving Social Security and other government benefits. The Fed chairman said that overcompensation is the result of a flawed inflation gauge. He suggested a two-track approach to correct what he considers an exaggeration in the Consumer Price Index. Greenspan's comments came before the House Budget Committee. The Ohio River in Cincinnati is still rising after reaching flood stage over the weekend. It's the worst flooding there in 30 years. Marianne Zalesnik of member station WNKU reports.
Forecasters say the river will crest tomorrow night 12 feet above flood stage. The last time the Ohio was that high was in 1964. Streets along the river in downtown Cincinnati and neighboring northern Kentucky are closed, with some evacuating their homes. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Lott says more rain is forecast for the area late tonight and tomorrow morning.
Right now it doesn't look like that big of a system, so it shouldn't do too much to affect their rivers or anything like that.
The flooding started after heavy rains fell along the river over the weekend. South of Cincinnati in Falmouth, Kentucky, residents are just beginning to clean up from record floods, which the National Guard says devastated the town. For National Public Radio, I'm Marianne Zalesnik in Highland Heights, Kentucky.
President Clinton returns to his home state of Arkansas today to survey the devastation caused by weekend tornadoes in Little Rock and Arkadelphia, about 65 miles away. The twisters killed at least 25 people. Another report on the sales of new homes in January from NPR's John Idsley.
New home sales were up 8.6% in January. On a seasonally adjusted level, the sales were running at a rate of 870,000 units per year. That's the highest level since March of 1986. Low mortgage rates and moderate growth helped to fuel sales, along with the warm weather in some areas of the country. However, the Commerce Department says the gains may be overstated because it has introduced a new computerized method of collecting home sales data, which might initially contain an upward bias. The strength in the housing market was not anticipated by analysts, and along with a number of reports yesterday, it suggests the economy is picking up speed. The Index of Leading Indicators, also released today, adds to that evidence. It is up 0.3%. I'm John Edstein in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 3.07 to 6921.99. Trading is heavy. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up 6.81 to 1317.99. This is NPR News. President Clinton said today that cloning human beings is not just a scientific issue, but one of spirituality. He wants to prevent any such research until a medical ethics advisory panel studies the issue. Therefore, the president issued a directive barring any federal agency from supporting, funding, or undertaking research on human cloning. Mr. Clinton also wants a voluntary moratorium on all privately funded human cloning experiments. The president says that new research over the weekend raises the prospect it might be possible to clone humans. He was referring to the cloning of two rhesus monkeys in Oregon. With a state of emergency in effect across Albania, police and army troops are carrying out security sweeps. A curfew has been imposed. In the capital, Tirana, it was quiet overnight, though there were isolated reports of gunfire. The BBC's Bob Simpson reports from Tirana.
A massive police operation ensured that the curfew was observed, with groups of armed, uniformed and plainclothes police on every corner, stopping cars and pedestrians. Within an hour or so of it coming into effect, the only vehicles moving were those being used by the police and military. Just after dawn, a few pedestrians were on the move, presumably those with permits allowing them to get to work on essential services. Albanian radio reported that there was continuing trouble in some of the southern towns where the disturbances have now been going on for 2 months. It spoke of what it described as terrorists overwhelming the police station in Tepelini and freeing prisoners, and of other places remaining chaotic. However, there was mention also of the police and military undertaking widespread security operations in Lesinje and Bolsh, directed at seizing unauthorized arms and working to reimpose law and order.
The BBC's Bob Simpson. A congressional committee says far too many government documents are stamped secret and a legacy of the Cold War that deprives the public and even policymakers of vital information. This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. The controversy over a late-term abortion method has been revived after a leading abortion rights advocate admitted he deliberately understated the frequency of the procedure. Last year, both houses of Congress passed a ban on what opponents call partial birth abortions, but President Clinton vetoed the measure. Since then, state legislatures have taken up the issue. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
President Clinton's veto didn't put an end to the controversy. In fact, it has provoked a powerful reaction. Some 30 states are now considering bills that would ban the late-term method, dilation and extraction, a procedure that opponents have termed partial birth abortion. Kate Michaelman with the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League says it's extraordinary that there have been so many bills proposed in such a short time.
There are more than 70 bills in 30 states. That's unprecedented on any of the issues that concern reproductive rights, abortion or family planning or any of the reproductive rights issues that we work on. That's an unprecedented number of bills on any one issue.
And that was before the events of last week, when the executive director of the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, Ron Fitzsimmons, said he lied about the number of partial birth abortions that are performed each year. Fitzsimmons originally said there were about 450 of these procedures. Now he says the method is used perhaps in 5,000 abortions a year, both in the second and third trimesters. We do know that there are about 1.5 million abortions performed each year, but there is no way to determine exactly exactly how many so-called partial birth procedures are done, because doctors are not required to keep these kinds of records. However, this revelation from an abortion rights activist has intensified the battle over this issue in Congress and in the states. A measure to ban partial birth abortions has already made it through both the House and Senate in South Dakota, where passage was quick and easy, according to Dan Wunro with South Dakota Right to Life.
Certainly the congressional debate has really raised everyone's interest in this issue. You know, when I went around and spoke to legislators getting their support as co-sponsors, this was one issue, certainly regarding the abortion issue in general, that when I brought up partial birth abortion, every legislator cringed at it and said, I'm signing on, every legislator I talked to.
As a result, in less than a month's time, the bill had been introduced, debated, and passed. South Dakota's governor, Republican William Jenklow, is expected to sign it into law soon. In that conservative Midwestern state, legislators considered a single version of the ban, but some states are considering several pieces of legislation. Alabama tops the list with 11 separate bills on this issue, among them a proposal that would create a constitutional amendment so that every resident could vote on the partial birth abortion ban. President of the Alabama Pro-Life Coalition, Eric Johnston, has helped oversee the legislative effort. Even he says some conservatives who are introducing bills have gone too far.
If you look at what partial birth abortion is as being a very popular issue that has been made popular by the Republican Congress, but the extent, to me at least, and I think a lot of others in the pro-life community, is questioned, how much good does it actually do? Is it more rhetoric than it is something of actual substance? And when you look at it in that way, then it would call attention to the politicians who are introducing that type of legislation.
Johnston says three of the bills in Alabama have a good chance of passing. His favorite is one that includes a ban on the procedure, coupled with a prohibition on all abortions done after viability. That would be at around 6 months, when a fetus could survive outside the womb. Coordinator of Alabamians for Choice, Michael Wilson, acknowledges that her opponents are dedicated and well-organized, that they're making it difficult for legislators to oppose them. If any of the bills make it out onto the floor for a vote, Wilson says it will be difficult to gauge which side would win.
It's hard to pin down. There are certainly people who are very vocally pro-choice, and there are some people who are dedicated anti-choice people. And then the vast majority of them are someplace in between. They're sort of reasonable kinds of people who would prefer that they not have to do anything unpleasant one way or the other.
At least one state that is debating the ban on the late-term abortion method may be doing so needlessly, according to the governor's office. Spokesman for Missouri Governor, Democrat Mel Carnahan, says legislators have introduced bills to ban a procedure that's already against the law. Chris Sifford says the state prohibits any type of abortion after viability. So he says the recent efforts to ban partial birth abortion after viability amount to political grandstanding.
This is not about public policy in Missouri. It's about the politics of the abortion debate. And the zealots, if you will, the extremists on this issue, simply want to pass another anti-choice piece of legislation. And that's their agenda. And that's unfortunate, because this is not an issue that needs to be further politicized.
That seems quite unlikely, given the fact that so many states are considering the bans and that the issue is about to erupt again on Capitol Hill. All this debate in the legislatures may just be a prelude to a debate in the courts about how far the Supreme Court decision, which legalized abortion, extends. The nation's highest court did not specifically mention this procedure, and the states are often used as testing grounds to challenge Roe versus Wade. I'm Kathy Lohr reporting.
Rescue workers in the Midwest say at least 48 people are known to have died in tornadoes and floods over the weekend. The tornadoes hit Arkansas, rivers flooded in Tennessee, Indiana, West Virginia, Ohio, and Kentucky. In many places, the floodwaters are going down. On the Ohio River, they are still rising. The river is expected to crest tomorrow night at Cincinnati. From member station WNKU, Marianne Zalesnik reports.
The Ohio River is predicted to crest at 12 feet above flood stage. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Lott says heavy weekend rains that fell close to the river caused it to rise more quickly than usual.
This is pretty unusual to get this much rain in such a short period of time. Looking back through the record books, it looks like this is the worst event we've had since probably 1964.
Hundreds of people in a trailer park in Covington, Kentucky have been evacuated. In Ohio, crews have been working to encourage people to seek higher ground. Cincinnati Fire Chief Tom Steidel says some people are reluctant to leave.
I think I was a little surprised by some of the calls we got from people who, you know, it was an obvious situation where they needed to evacuate. Mm-hmm. In a lot of cases, they seem to be waiting for someone to tell them to evacuate when the reality is, you know, it's time to move, get your vehicles and move things.
Across the river from Cincinnati in Covington, they're used to dealing with floodwaters. Lawyer Pat Flannery has been in his historic river home since 1954. As movers packed up his piano and other belongings, the atmosphere was more like a party than a flood with a table of food and drink out for family and friends.
Just have to roll with the punches. You know, there's nothing you can do. You just have to accept what comes.
Adapting to the changing river is a little easier for the boats that just rise with the water. General Manager of BB Riverboats, Alan Rizzo, says he's worked on the river for 15 years, and this is the worst he's ever seen it. But he says his crews used more line to secure the fleet to the docks.
Well, I think it's about as dangerous as it can get, but they have a good respect for the river, and we're being very careful, working in teams and doing everything we can to be safe. Everybody respects the river. They know what can happen.
Meanwhile, south of Cincinnati in Falmouth, Kentucky, residents are starting to dig out from record flooding over the weekend. David Altum is a spokesman with the State Department of Military Affairs.
The infrastructure has been heavily damaged. The police station, for example, was wiped clean. There's no police sedans there. They're having to resort to support from the state police and also from the National Guard there in terms of security.
Kentucky Governor Paul Patton has asked President Clinton to declare 9 counties major disaster areas. More rain is forecast late tonight, but meteorologist Lott says it should not be heavy enough to make things any worse. For National Public Radio, I'm Marianne Zalesnik in Highland Heights, Kentucky.
Of the 533 current members of Congress, 282 are Republicans and 250 are Democrats. A quick bit of math reveals that leaves one seat for Vermont's Congressman Bernie Sanders. The body's independent. He's a socialist in his fourth term. House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt named Sanders the ranking minority member on a government reform and oversight subcommittee. Sanders says taking the top Democratic spot on a subcommittee does not undercut his independent status. It enhances it.
For the first time in probably American history, somebody who's outside of the two-party system is going to have a little bit more clout by being a ranking member of one of the important subcommittees in the government reform committee.
Why did you want that role, which more closely than ever allies you with the Democratic Party?
Well, that's the committee that I was on, and that's the seniority situation that I was eligible for.
But doesn't this ally you...
Well, I think if you look at my record in the United States Congress, you will find that as the only independent, I have led the effort against both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and that my effort is to speak up for working people and low-income people and elderly people who are not getting a fair shake from government. So I would suggest that if anyone checks my record, you will find that it is probably as strong and as progressive as any member of the United States Congress.
So if the Republicans had offered you a subcommittee chairmanship, you would have gladly accepted?
No, of course I would not have. The Republican agenda, by and large, is to represent the wealthiest people and the most powerful people in this country. While I have many disagreements with the Democrats, obviously, given the choice between the two, the Democratic situation and positions are often preferable.
In fact, you've voted with the Democratic majority 95% of the time. What's the difference between a socialist and a liberal Democrat?
Well, I'm glad that you asked me that. Number one, it's the issues that I raise and the issues that I fight for. Number one of the problems that we're having in this country today is that in many ways we are ceasing to be a democracy. Now, this is an issue that Democrats don't talk about, Republicans don't talk about, and the corporately owned media doesn't talk about. But one of the real problems that we have is that tens of millions of people are giving up on the political process because they perceive that the United States Congress and the government ends up representing the wealthy and the powerful and not the needs of ordinary people. Now, we don't talk about this. 2 years ago, when Gingrich and his friends took over, 38% of the people voted. In a very important presidential election, 49% of the people voted. My guess is that in 2 years, in the next congressional election, you have barely more than one-third of the people voting. Now, that's a very serious problem. We have seen in the last 20, 25 years a significant decline in the standard of living of working people, the collapse of the middle class. Who's talking for those people? Certainly not the Republican Party, which very overtly represents the wealthy and the powerful, and unfortunately, most members of the Democratic Party are not standing up for working people either.
So, why not become a Democrat, change the party from within as you move up to more power within that party?
Well, I prefer and believe very strongly that at this moment in history, the Congress needs at least one independent who stands up and calls it the way it is.
The congressional leadership is much more conservative now, even within the Republican Party, since you first entered Congress. Has that changed how other members relate to you?
Well, what is going on, it's not congressional leadership. You have seen in the United States Congress a strong drift to the right in both political parties. You have now a right wing in the Republican Party, which clearly controls that party, which is far further than to the right than was the case 15 or 20 years ago. And you have a Democratic leadership now, which in some respects might be considered to be liberal Republican. President Clinton, for example, his politics in many ways, excluding Watergate and so forth, is not terribly different than was Richard Nixon's. So you're seeing both parties moving to the right, which means to say that the needs of working people, low-income people, the elderly, the kids, are just not being dealt with. And that is an opening that I think many of us have got to seize.
So there's very little that Congress has achieved of late that you could be proud of.
Well, I would say that some of us in the Progressive Caucus played a role in stopping the worst elements of what Gingrich wanted to do, and that's something to be proud of. Last year, we ended up putting more money into education, and that's something that we are very proud of. But I think it's fair to say, and most Americans, I'm sure, do not disagree, that the Congress represents the wealthy and the powerful. The middle class shrinks. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world, and the rich get richer. We're not going to change that system until tens and tens of millions of working people get involved in the political process, and they fight for a national health care system which guarantees health care to all people. They fight for the right for every kid in this country to be able to get a decent college education. We fight for a fair tax system which asks the question why the wealthiest paying lower taxes, their tax rates have gone down, while the middle class pays more because Social Security taxes have gone up. This is a great country. There are many things that we can do. The basic problem is both your economic and political system are dominated by big money interests.
Socialism hasn't exactly been gaining ground in recent years. How does your idea of
socialism... Well, democratic socialism, in fact, is not communism, and I hope you understand that. I was a very strong opponent of authoritarian communism, of course. In terms of democratic socialism, the Labour Party in England is now 20 or 30 points ahead of the Conservatives, will probably become the next government of England. You have a Labour Party in Sweden in power. You have a Labour, New Democratic Party in power in provinces in Canada. So, you know, things go up and down, but democratic socialism is alive and thriving.
Yeah, but how do you square your idea of socialism with that of Congress and the American people, since politicians seem to drift the way they feel the voters are going?
Well, I don't feel... Well, I was elected by 23 points in the last election in the state of Vermont, so I suppose the voters are not unhappy with what I'm doing. I think if you had more members of Congress, I think your question is not right. It's not where the voters are going. I think many politicians perceive where the money goes. To get elected, you have to get money from wealthy people and large corporations, and you do what they want. That means you fight for tax breaks for the rich, and you cut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and education. I think the views that I reflect and represent not only reflect the interests of the vast majority of the people in Vermont, but the vast majority of the people nationwide. Now, why those views are not better represented in Congress has to do with the corporate media, which to a large degree does not allow those views out. Number two, it has to do with the two-party system, which is heavily controlled by big money interests.
Congressman Bernie Sanders is a socialist from Vermont.